It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, Farm to Table Talk can't ignore the fact that there's some broad issues affecting our current and future food production and the impact of climate change. Well, there's many organizations, many individuals that are looking at climate change and finding ways to address it in the long run. I've got one of those folks with me today. I want to welcome Jimmy Dawkus, who's a senior program officer with American Farmland Trust. Jimmy, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Jimmy, and Farm to Table Talk, we're talking usually about how food is produced. One thing that most of the food that we're consuming is produced, it starts off with the land. It starts off with how we're treating the land. And your organization is pretty focused on land. That's why you even got it in your name, farmland. And as I understand it, Jimmy, part of that is that you see farmland has been disappearing more quickly than most of us realize.
Yes. Well, let me just give you the the overview on American Farmland Trust. We're the only national conservation organization that is dedicated to protecting farmland and promoting environmentally sound farming practices and keeping farmers on the land. So as you said, we're really focused on the land. And we really look at our kind of tagline of no farms, no food as kind of summing it up. And one of the challenges that we have been focused on since we started in 1980 is the loss of farm and ranch land to urbanizing development, and in particular, that kind of sprawling development that's ill-planned and isn't a good use of our land. And what we found in a report that we just released in May is that we have been losing farm and ranch land at a rate of 1.5 million acres each year. And some of that is from urban development, and but a large portion of it also is to what we call residential fragmentation. So it's the breaking up of some of the ag lands. And that's a real problem for the future of farm and ranch land in the United States. And I think that'll have an impact on future ability to grow food and fiber.
Did I hear you right? Did you say it was 1.5 million acres?
Yes, that's 1.5 million acres. That actually translates to 3 acres, just about 3 acres per minute. So as we're having this conversation, you know, acres of ag land are being converted. We believe that that's unsustainable. And also one of the things that we found in the study is that a significant portion of that is among our best land, the land that we look at for intensive food and fiber production. So it's that productive, versatile, resilient land. And that is a real problem as we consider our future.
Now, let's paint a picture of that for the average person. Now, what I think of when you describe that is sprawl, is that there's city limits and they just keep expanding and putting another suburb out and strip malls. That's the picture I get. How close is that to the reality?
So that is part of that reality. The other reality, which is a little more invisible, is when you get, especially as you look out in kind of more towards the western parts of the nation, and you get the fragmentation of some of the ranch land. It may not look like a strip mall the way we're normally thinking of and the photos of sprawl development, but it effectively takes that land out of agricultural production, right? And so even if you have, 10-acre plots, which, sounds pretty good, that if you take hundreds of acres and break it up into, what we call ranchettes, that's another aspect of this loss or conversion of ag land out of production. And so that's another problem, and that's a growing problem.
If there's that much taken out of production, whatever you could grow on 1 million acres, you're losing that every year. So if you converted that to say I'm planting whatever, tomatoes or potatoes or corn or any of that, a million acres seems like that'd feed a lot of people. I don't know if you've done any examples of you know, how many pounds of this or that is missing.
Well, of course, yeah. I don't have that off the top of my head. I think we should. Yeah, of course, that depends on, you know, kind of what you're growing. But you're right. It translates into real loss in productivity or our ability to, you know, produce our, you know, our food and it's our feed. And what you also find is that, some of this, occurs in areas that are in and around urban areas, right? And so it makes sense. Our forefathers and mothers, when we were creating our cities, put those down right near some of the most fertile land. Well, over the last 200 years, as we've been growing, and in particular the last 20 to 30 years, we have been sprawling out on some of that really excellent farmland. So, part of the problem is that we're losing some of our, you know, our prime soils, and we're covering those up. And that has an even, you know, an outsized impact on this production. The other thing is, you know, this has an impact on our environment, and that often is not something that people are realizing.
So expand on that a little bit. When you're talking about the impact on our environment, is this going to get us into the potential impacts on climate change?
So American Farmland Trust also, in protecting ag land, believes that there is a win-win situation where we could be protecting ag land and improving soil health on that land. And that's great for agriculture, as we've been talking about, right, to reduce the loss of that land, and then also improve soil health to improve the productivity and resilience. The win-win there is that if we're doing that, that has a significant impact on reducing greenhouse gases, and also drawing down some of the carbon from the atmosphere and sequestering it. So there's sort of two things going on. One is, and this is how we think about our work on climate change, is on the land side, you want to protect the best land and you want to promote compact growth, because sprawling development actually uses more greenhouse gases. So that's just going the wrong direction, right? That's increasing greenhouse gases. So protect the best land and promote compact growth. And then on that land, you want to improve conservation practices so that you're actually improving the productivity of the land, but you are also what's called, you know, drawing down or sequestering carbon. That is taking the carbon out of the atmosphere, and you're locking it up down into the soil, into the plants. And that's a positive for climate change, while at the same time improving the soil health and ultimately the productivity of the land itself.
So two different pictures here. So if you're looking at, say, like a development, so they develop an area that had been farmland. They go in and tear it up, which releases carbon into the environment right there, I assume. And then they're using carbon with all of the fossil fuel and everything else in the development itself, and building houses or strip malls or breaking up the ground. And so maybe on that side you're putting more carbon into the environment with
yes.
the development, right?
Yes, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but
no,
absolutely,
right.
Just what you said. And what the other part of that, which is the, you know, sort of a big piece of that, is if you develop in a not compact way, not smart growth, right? We've been working on smart growth now for, you know, a couple of decades. But if you don't do that, you increase vehicle miles and other kinds of, you know, fossil fuels. So that actually increases overall greenhouse gases, right? Because you're driving in the car more and you're and making more trips. And so yes, that's the first part of it, right? So that's a bad thing. And if we do that, then the kind of the other kinds of things that we're trying to combat with climate change and trying to get, you know, more you know, vehicles that have better miles per gallon, but if we're increasing the miles that we're traveling, we're not actually getting better. And then the second part is the land itself. So let me, I'll give it back to you to try to paint that picture, and then I can comment.
How can you improve farmland so that you can build the soils up and capture more of that carbon?
Yeah, so the second part of it is trying to work with farmers and ranchers and landowners, right, customize conservation cropping systems that work for their operations and their geography and their crops, right? So it's, you know, the United States is an enormous country, and it varies a lot, the amount of rain, the types of soils and stuff. But for almost every one of those acres, there are practices that producers can adopt that can help to improve soil. So it, one example is changing from, changing to conservation tillage, where you are tilling the land less. Another is to have cover crops so that there is something growing on the land throughout the year. So that would be like if you imagine during the winter not having a bare dirt field, which leads to soil erosion and things, having cover crops. Another is how you handle your fertilizer management. And then lastly, just crop rotation. So all of those together are a system, and it's referred to by many different words or terms, but it can be conservation cropping systems. Other people like to call it carbon farming. But those practices draw down carbon into the soil, and that improves the soil and holding capacity for water, so that helps during droughts. It is the absorption capacity, so that helps when there's really heavy rains. And so that can help with the resiliency of the land.
So when you say it draws the carbon down, is it the kind of cover crop that is really pulling carbon out of the air, or the kind of or trees or other things? What kind of vegetation is contributing the most to being able to pull carbon out of the atmosphere?
Well, so all plants, absorb carbon, right? This is just part of the photosynthesis that plants go through. But it is true that, you know, different plants sequester or draw down more carbon. And there's a lot of work being done by a lot of research by universities and other groups to try to identify some of the, in this case, say, the cover crops that, you know, draw down and lock up the most carbon. Mm-hmm. And so there's really good research going on, and we're really at the cutting edge of this. And I think that there's lots of improvements that can be made. But also, to your point, you know, trees draw down a tremendous amount of carbon. And that's why, you know, as we look at this, we often think of how do we get people to be thinking, and policymakers to be thinking, about this natural solution to address this climate issue. How do we build up our forests through forest management? How do we improve our soils for ag and ranch land to draw down more carbon? Because there's lots and lots of, you know, what we call co-benefits or additional benefits from doing this. So that sounds like a really, you know, again, win-win situation if we're helping to address climate change and also improving kind of the land itself.
You know, Jimmy, the thing that I think about is growing up on a farm, seems like we were always plowing and disking and harrowing and turning soil over and over and over again. And in hindsight, back when we did that, we were releasing lots of carbon, weren't we?
You were releasing lots of carbon, and you also probably were losing a bunch of your most valuable asset, which was your productive soil during the winter. And our friend John Scholl tells a story about farms when he was growing up and how it looked so beautiful, all tilled. And then there was a guy down the street who used to have this raggedy-looking field because he would leave some of the stubble. But it turned out that that guy started producing more and being a little more resilient, doing better in droughts. And it's just part of, as we're learning more, we're learning that there are some practices that can help improve the soil, and then that has some direct correlation to yield and productivity and yield variation over time, you know, and that resilience. And so it's a question of trying to work with producers and farmers within their own systems to try to introduce and get them to adopt some practices that work for them, but that also work for the environment.
Are ownership issues, do they figure into this at all, or do you see any trends in the size or geographic location of the farms as to whether they're adopting the techniques that you're promoting more or less than other areas?
Yeah, it's a great, great question, and you're asking it because you're so knowledgeable about, you know, farming and producers and renting, and, you know, just the simple size of the farm doesn't determine that, you know. There are farmers that are very innovative in doing many of these practices on large tracts of land. We're at on a farm in Indiana, 5,000 acres, and I've been doing conservation cropping system for nearly 20 years. But one of the issues that we have found and others, and we've identified as a barrier to this kind of widespread adoption of these conservation practices, is the relationship between kind of the renter and producer, especially if you're having non-operating landowners and also even absentee, that is people who are farther away from the farm, right? You know, not just down the road or in the same town, but, you know, maybe in a different state. And that, and in the Midwest, some of those percentages of the rent, the percent of rental land goes up close to 70 or 80% in parts of Illinois. And that relationship can be a barrier to adoption. What we find is, from surveys, is that both the landowner and the producer would like to do more conservation on their land, but they're not sure how to actually interact or talk with or, you know, step on the toes of the other. And so we and a couple of other groups are working on this non-operating landowner. In fact, we're doing a survey in 10 of the states that have the highest percentages of non-operating landowners to really understand this issue and figure out how we could overcome that. And we figure if we could try to understand better how to get the two talking, and some of it may be an extended lease, right? Many of the leases are year to year, but many of the leases or the relationship between the landowner and the producer are more than a decade long, which means that you have the relationship long enough, but you don't, because it's going year to year, maybe you don't have the situation where someone feels comfortable taking the risk and doing the investment if it takes a couple of years to sort of work through some of these processes. So that's a sort of exciting part of our work.
Yeah, because I would think that if you are struggling and you just get land rented and you only know you've got at least for a year and you're not even sure about the year, it's pretty tough for you to be making decisions for, you know, the very, very long term. I mean, the pressure's on just to probably have minimal expenses and do everything you can to cut down your expenses and maximize your productivity in the short term, which doesn't necessarily coincide with good conservation practices.
No, in fact, there's a you know, there's some survey work from the Conservation Technology Innovation Center (CTIC) that surveys producers and landowners, and what they found is that some of the producers will tell you that who both own land and rent land, is that they do more conservation practices on the land that they own than the land they rent. So think about that. That you have a producer who knows that these practices are helping with his soil health and ultimately with his productivity and resilience, right? So he's doing it on his land, But he also then is renting land, but because of that relationship, just the fact that he's renting it as opposed to owning it, or it's a short-term, to your point, it's a short-term rental, right, which, you know, makes it a worse mm-hmm. situation. They're just not doing practices that they already know are good for their bottom line. That is a problem.
How many of the farms are doing the right thing for the long term, for the health of the land and for the climate in the long term, and how many of them are probably failing at it?
You know, I haven't done it the way that you just described that. You can see from some of the USDA reports, which are the CEAP, they're called the CEAP, C-E-A-P, Conservation Environment Assessment Project or Program. That's sort of the best kind of across the nation look at it. And, you know, and what you find is that producers, farmers and ranchers have done a lot and have adopted a lot of practices over the last, you know, 10 or 20 years, but also you find that there's many more things that they sort of could do. And so, right, progress being made, but still, you know, work to be done. One of the things that American Farmland Trust and other organizations do is try to drill down and work in a kind of a sub-watershed. And there you try to, not to do the study that you just said of, you know, who's doing it right and who's doing it wrong, but how do you put your arms around and get all the partners together, like the local soil and water conservation districts and the NRCS agents and the producers and ag organizations all working together to try to increase kind of the awareness and then sharing the experiences of the different producers. And so some of these sub-watershed projects are now starting to show some results in increasing adoption and having that build momentum as people see what's going on, see other people doing it successfully, and then trying it on their own farms.
You know, one other variation on the role of the absentee landlord, I think of, is you hear a lot about foreign companies investing in American agriculture. Do you come across any of those companies and seeing whether or not they're taking these kind of conservation steps that are good for the land?
I cannot answer that. So I don't know and haven't really heard that is one of the driving forces. So I just don't know. I know that, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I've just had people that listen to this podcast
yep.
that have asked me, and they just say, we hear that these foreign entities are coming in, and it's hard for them to believe that they're necessarily doing it for the long haul, that they're making an investment and they're suspect. I mean, they live in a whole different country. And so
yeah.
they wonder how much they care about the local community, let alone what they're doing to the earth. It's
yeah,
that's people's mind.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And I think that translates to, you know, not just foreign ownership, but you know, out of state ownership and the large kind of management. I just can't comment on to your question of whether that translates
sure.
and how that translates. Since one of the things that we're very excited about is what we're finding on the ground, and if in fact this is good for kind of the bottom line. If it's good for your yield to rebuild and to regenerate your soil, then that's going to be a great thing for everyone. Everyone's going to be wanting to do it. It's not like, oh, I should do some cost share to do this. Should I be doing it for a water quality benefit or a climate benefit or something? These are things that are going to help you in your bottom line. Then I would think all the owners of the land would be wanting to have their land be managed this way because you'd be building up the asset long term.
Sure. So it's easy if they make more money, if you can prove to them that it's not only doing the right thing, but it also improves their income. And yet I think the public would hope that there's a lot of them are just doing it because it's the right thing to do. And then there's another level, though, too, I suppose, and that is for those that view it as additional cost. And not only do they not necessarily make more money from it, but if doing these things actually costs more to rotate and to, you know, that sort of thing, that's quite a sacrifice. And maybe there's some people that are able to do that, and probably many others, that that's pretty tough to do.
Yeah,
they can't even break even.
Yeah, and I think in the end, you can't ask the farmers and ranchers to be doing those kinds of things without, you know, if they're public benefits on private land, I think we should be sharing the cost. That's what we often say, whether it's by putting an easement on land to keep it, you know, active and open space and productive, or if you're doing cost share for some of these practices. And it's, you know, it's not true for everyone. There's a lot more research to make the case, as you said, and to show people that it, you know, works everywhere to increase the kind of the bottom line or increase the productivity.
Well, you know, consumers, I think, would like to buy food that's grown in a fashion that is protecting the earth and taking positive steps toward climate change. Do you see any evidence of some of these programs, people that are able to capitalize on their story and have that help the marketing message of whatever crops they're growing?
Yeah, I think that is a really exciting area. There's a lot of activity there. There's a lot of interest. People are trying to really understand. And you got two kind of forces. One is at the really large, supply chain of large corporations that are involved in, food. And beverages, right? They're trying to understand the environmental impact. They may be making commitments, sustainability commitments, either for water or for carbon or climate. And so they're trying to understand their whole supply chain, and that is helping to try to look at how do we do that better, and then how do we support, you know, all along the way, how do we support better practices? And, you know, one of the people in that supply chain is it starts with the producers. So that's very active and really has an opportunity. Actually getting paid extra to produce that way is much rarer. So that's the question of whether these efforts in supply chain will result in more or a higher price for producers. The second area is really more on that niche side and the companies that are either organic or sustainable and working in that area, and some of them are local, and those companies, there's a lot of real experimentation and working to try to figure out how to do exactly what you said, which is to support farmers and ranchers in producing the food in a sustainable way, and that is actually carbon farming and drawing down the carbon while rebuilding the soil, and trying to find ways to support and to try to have a premium. And those are exciting. Those are still new and rare, but it's a really exciting area.
So if you've got some neighbors and they say, Jimmy, you're doing this all the time. If I want to buy food that is sustainably produced, how do I do that? I mean, what do I look for? What does that tell me about a farmer if they're claiming that it's a sustainable production?
Well, at this point, we being the United States, doesn't have a label that says this or that is sustainable or grown in a particular way, right? We have, organic standards, and so that's one thing, and that tells you an aspect of how some of the food is produced. There are other claims in terms of, grass-based and some of those different kinds of things, but in terms of our, especially for the vast majority of acres that are related to, commodity crops, there isn't a differentiation at this point for corn or beans that are grown with or without conservation tillage or with or without cover crops. So that still is a dilemma, and that means that we don't really have the connection between the consumer and those kinds of practices, and that's a problem.
Well, it is a problem, I think, for a lot of people who'd like to know more. But what, but you've been mentioning some things that seems to be key words in sustainability. So if people care enough and they want to know how whatever the food is grown and they look into it, they can usually probably find information on websites. And it seems like most companies now are talking a little bit about their farmers and farming practices. And when you were describing people that are sustainable, and I'm going to put words in your mouth and you can correct me now. But one would be that they're tilling less. When tilling is, you know, plowing, drilling, you know, cultivating, turning the dirt over and over and over again, you know, using more fossil fuels and so forth in that process. So one of them is that they are, they've made an effort to till less. Would that be true?
Yes.
And then you said cover crops.
Yes.
And then you said something about fertilizer management, crop rotation.
Yep. So on a sort of cropping side, those are sort of four major sort of, you know, practices that, you know, either are carbon farming or are conservation cropping system. So reduce tillage, use cover crops, right? Keep the ground covered, right? Adopting, you know, nutrient management that tries to place the fertilizer when, you know, needed. So it's, you know, using it and placing it at the right time in the right type of fertilizer, in the right place. And so, that means that it gets used most efficiently. So, and then lastly is, having some crop rotations helps to you know, have diversification, and that helps with the soil as well. So that's sort of on that cropping side. And then on the other, you know, on the livestock side is really, you know, the management and manure management and how you handle that, and that can have a big impact on the environment and on greenhouse gases as well.
You know, though, Jimmy, as we talk, I don't think we're going to solve the problem right now. It does lack a simple brand. You know, everybody's still talking about sustainability, and they've been doing it for a number of years now. And yet what you and I are describing, we know this direction makes sense. And I think that consumers with care would know that, too. But, again, other than somebody just say everything's sustainably grown, there's a huge gap yet through more education and explanation.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, we support and believe that the, you know, the consumer movement to get to know your food and to be supporting, you know, local and regional farms and ranches makes a whole lot of sense, and that's a growing awareness, and that will continue to grow. And you're asked, you know, the idea that people really even ask where their food comes from and how it was grown is really important. And then I will just go back to what I said before. I think we believe that there's a real opportunity to be conducting that kind of research that helps unlock some of the practices that can help both of the bottom lines there, right? Help the environment, but also improve the productivity. And if we can do that, I think that will unlock a lot of activity across tens of millions of acres. And that's what we really need to have a scale impact. We think it's possible. And, you know, some of that becomes questions of communication and technical assistance. And that's why we're involved in policy. And that's why we're involved in Farm Bill, because still most of the money for these kinds of practice changes comes from our federal Farm Bill. And we need to have a really strong conservation title, and we need to have really strong funding for technical assistance, so people are out there in our conservation districts and our local NRCS agents and our universities are out there, you know, working to help our farmers, ranchers, and landowners.
Jimmy, the American Farmland Trust has been working in this area for some time, and I'm curious, aside from the politics and the policies that you have to be involved with, What gives you the most hope about the next several years? What are you engaged in that you feel good about and you think that you're going to even feel better about it a couple of years down the road?
I think it's really when you're out meeting the people who are on the ground, who are so dedicated to this. And I mean both farmers, ranchers, and landowners who love their land and are out there working it, but also the, you know, advisors and the people who are working with them and helping them. They are so dedicated to this. We're just seeing, you know, changes on the ground, and it takes a long time to change behavior, because that's what's happening, and it's happening in a situation where, you know, there's risk involved. But when you're out there on the field and you're seeing it and you're seeing changes, one of the examples is, you know, again, this is for the Midwest. Cover crops don't work everywhere, but it's really an important practice. What we're finding and what some of the advisors are saying is, you know, if we can work with a farmer for a couple of years, working with them on cover crops and, you know, sort of working through different species and timing of it and different things like that, if we can get through the first one or two, if we get to year three, if we get past that, then people don't ever stop using cover crops. And so that's really exciting. They get it, and they've figured it out, and they now. So if we think of it as a transition, it gives me a lot of optimism that we can see changes that will be sustained on the land that will have impacts into the future. Some of the people who are most open to this and excited about it are the, you know, the next generation of farmers who are coming up. So I think there's a lot of optimism, but the reality is that it does take a while to change behavior.
Well, I'm going to add a note to that, too. I mean, I think all the points you made are excellent on why we should be optimistic. But the other one I'm going to say is tomorrow's consumers. Millennials, mm-hmm. All the surveys that I'm seeing is that they feel this is more and more important. And even to the point that if it costs a little bit more money, they're willing to spend more money. Food matters and how it's produced. And the generation following, they're saying, are going to go even more so than millennials. So I think on the consumer side, too, it's heading the right direction. So these young farmers that you were talking about that are trying to make the changes and make the improvements, and they're going to find a ready market for their products in the future.
Absolutely, I agree.
Kind of sustainability.
Yes, I think that's a really good point.
Well, it's exciting. If people want to know more about this.
So if you go onto the World Wide Web and you type in www.farmland, one word, FARMLAND.org, you get our website, and we have a lot of information there and links to other places. I think that we hope that people will go there and consider our work, learn about it, as you said, become more educated consumers. And I hope that they will consider becoming members of American Farmland Trust.
Well, I tell you what, Jimmy Dawkus of American Farmland Trust, I really appreciate your being on Farm to Table Talk today.
Well, thank you. It was a really wide-ranging and a very interesting discussion. So I hope that we can do it again sometime and maybe drill down into one area.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.